Happy New Year and welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Thanks for all the support in 2017. To kick things off in 2018, we'll have a two-part podcast with golf course architect Jim Urbina. If you don't or haven't already, please subscribe to our podcast at iTunes and rate and review us. Now, here's Jim Urbina.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today I'm joined by golf course architect Jim Urbina. Jim, welcome on.
Good morning, Andy. Thanks for having me on. Wonderful day to talk about golf.
I don't know if there is a bad day to talk about golf.
Well, let's just say this is the best day to talk about golf.
So, Jim, you've had a great career so far, and you've been doing quite a bit of restoration work at a lot of high profile places. So I think, you know, my first question is, how do you get a club to buy in on a restoration?
You know, that's always tough, because when I get that phone call, when somebody reaches out to me and asks me about a club, a particular club, a Greens Committee chairman, a club president, somebody who is associated with the club, they call me and ask me, what do you know about a particular golf course? Would you be interested in talking to us about it? I'm always skeptical, and the only reason I say skeptical is I'm always skeptical about what the intent is. What is your phone call about? What is your goal? And so when you ask that question, how do I get a club to buy in? You know, the first question I always ask when we get into a roundtable discussion or we gather as a group and a committee starts to interview me or ask me questions, the first question I always ask is, do you embrace history? And the place goes very quiet. And so the reason the place goes quiet is because I'm not sure that they understand my question or if they've even thought about the history that their club may be a part of. And so I figured that we ought to start with the interview by me interviewing them, if that makes sense.
It makes a ton of sense. You know, you want to make sure that the committee is on the same page as you are and you know, kind of thinking along the same lines. I think that leads me into a question I'm always curious. It seems to be a polarizing topic with restoration. Do you believe in returning it back to the original place or restoring intent, which might lead to moving bunkers into different places to adopt for technology?
Depending on the architect, or as Pete Dye used to always tell me, Jim, we're not architects, we're builders. And I've kind of embraced that ever since. I always think about what the club represents, what the goals are of the club, and really, if this club or a club that has asked me to talk about their golf course, their history, is it something that it lends itself to a restoration? Because really, not all golf courses should be restored, if that makes sense to you. And the reason I say that is because some golf courses just don't have the architectural beauty, the architectural strategy that would interest me. And So when I talk to clubs and I ask them about the history, the reason I ask that question is because if they want to modernize it, if they want to modernize it by moving bunkers around, by changing greens, by flattening them out, I generally would say that I'm not the person you should be talking to. And I would excuse myself from the interview process because of that. So I tend not to think about a golf course I'm interviewing for as a modernization project, but I tend to lean towards restoration, and I've enjoyed that the most, and I've been the most successful at it.
Mm-hmm. It's with us. I mean, the golf courses and the era we now are, I feel like golden age golf courses are more popular than they've ever been before. Why do you think that?
Well, I just interviewed for a golden age design a few days ago. And one of the questions one of the committee people asked me was, well, Jim, what can you do to this golf course to make it enjoyable for the high handicap player as well as the scratch golfer? And my answer to him was emphatically, I don't think I could do both on this golf course. And that is the golf course that I'm interviewing for, because the golf course and its strategy and intent was different bunkers at different yardages off the tees with varying degrees of strategy involved. So if I was interviewing for a golf course that had bunker left, bunker right in the fairway at 260 yards out, and they wanted to move bunker left and bunker right in the fairway to 280, that would be something that has no interest at all for me. But if you have a golf course that has short bunker right, medium distance bunker left, center bunker 300 yards out, additional left fairway bunker at, let's say, 490, and I'm talking about a par 5 in this sense, if you can think with me, that each one of those bunkers offers something different for every level of player. And that's the golf courses I seek out. Because before I interview for a job, I want to be considered, I want to make sure that the golf course has something for everybody. And if I could bring that out in the restoration, then I will have succeeded. And I will have answered that gentleman's question that asked me, what can you do for all levels of players? And that's what I try to seek out. But very simplistic bunkering, bunker left, bunker right, as I said, does not interest me. And that's why McDonald and Rayner, a lot of Ross courses, the Bobolink Club that I just restored back in 2015 and 16 with Scott Pavelko, those are the golf courses that interest me because they have bunkers for all levels of players, but generally they get filled in because someone deems them uninteresting because they're only 210 yards off the tee. Yeah. Funny, isn't it?
It is. I was, those ones that are 210 yards off the tee provide, you know, thrill and interest for the senior or the lady golfer now, where they
Correct.
Used to be, you know, there for, you know, better players. But that was something I was really impressed with when I walked around Bobolink this summer was, the par five that runs along the, the south property line that has, you know,
yes.
bunker
yes.
left,
number
bunker
five.
Right. There's a
yep.
center line bunker. And I think you moved a green there. Am I right?
The green had actually was moved by another architect in the 80s, I believe, and I simply recaptured the essence of Allison with that green site location, making it feel more consistent with the other 16 greens that had not been touched since 1922 by Allison. So, yes, you are correct in that hole. It had several bunkers, each one at a different angle, each one at a different yardage off the tee. And you want to talk about a hole that embraces all levels of players, that's it.
Yeah, it was a very, very cool hole. In terms of with, you know, restoring golf courses, and let's just say, I'm, you know, a member, or I'm the head of a greens committee at a, you know, golden age golf course. And, you know, we want to start to, you know, get interest in restoration, and we are going to just take the first step. Like, what's usually what you see across courses, the smallest and easiest thing that most clubs could do to start to show what a restoration, how it could help the club and get more people to buy in?
You know, I wish more people asked me that in the interview process. One of the first things that I always look at when I walk onto a golf course, I mean, it's the very first thing I look at, is the mowing presentation. And I've been doing that since my early days at the Valley Club of Montecito in California, which I started working on in 96. Seems like forever ago. And when I look at the mowing presentation, I can tell that it has evolved. And we can go there if you want during the interview about the evolution of golf courses. But I noticed that the Valley Club of Montecito, the way the golf course was being presented, and if we could recapture what it used to look like, and I use the term look like because I look at old aerials and ground photos. For some reason, Alistair McKenzie loved to document himself on the golf course. And I'm thankful for that because I have great ground photos of the Valley Club of Montecito. I have great ground photos of Pasatiempo with McKenzie and Marion Hollins and Bobby Jones playing the golf course. So I was able to recapture the mowing presentation. And I always tell the clubs the first thing you could do, the cheapest thing you could do, is just represent how you mow the golf course. And a lot of superintendents would be more than happy to try that and show the club what could be done to recapture the strategy and the intent of these golden age designs. Just mowing the grass, it's that simple.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's one of the things you notice always when you look at an old aerial of almost every golden age golf course that hasn't been restored, you know, in the recent time, is that you see that the mowing lines on the greens and the fairways are just considerably smaller. So, you know, say in the case of like a Chicago area club where you have bluegrass rough, bent grass fairways, what do you suggest? How do you suggest you combat that if you wanted to extend out the fairways?
Every superintendent does it differently, and I generally defer to them with how they want to approach the recapturing of that different types of grasses, poa, rye, bent fairways versus a bluegrass rough, as you described. I've had the opportunity to work at two clubs in Chicago, the Glenview Club with Brian Moore, excellent superintendent, and as you know, the Bobby Lane Club and Scott Pavelko.
I actually caddied at Glenview for like 3 years too, so.
Well, you would be one of many caddies. They have an excellent caddy program.
Yeah,
and one of the greatest things about the Glenview Club, not to get off track, I apologize, is that there's peer pressure to walk by the membership, and there's peer pressure by the membership to take a caddy. And generally, you don't take a caddy, somebody's going to be staring you down wondering why you don't have a caddy on your bag. And for me, that's pretty impressive. But that speaks highly of the Chick Evans room that they have at the Glenview Club and how they support the caddy program, which I think is fabulous in the Chicago area. But to get back to grasses, every superintendent does it different. Some just mow it down and let it mature and evolve into a tight grass, a rye, a poa. Some sought them out. Some sought out the lines that I have repainted. In the case of a course that I'm restoring in Long Island, New York, Rockville Links, the superintendent, Luke Knutson, he uses the plugs from the fairways and spreads them out into the newly prepared area for fairway. And within 6 months, he's got the same looking fairway as he had prior to the restoration. So it's amazing how each superintendent attacks the situation differently, but really it's all grass and each one would tell you something different. He uses plugs to restore the fairways. And when you go back the next year, you'd never know where we expanded the fairways and where we took out the bluegrass rough. So everyone does it different.
Mm-hmm. That's I would love to see more people do that. And obviously sometimes you have trees and poor planting in the way, but you know, where you can, it makes such a difference because it adds so much strategy back to the golf course.
And you know, Andy, it can't be just the mowing presentation. We start with that, but really it's making sure the trees are the trees that are planted too close to the fairways, as part of what I talk about in the evolution of the golf course. Trees that are planted too close, bushes that are planted too close, rose gardens that are planted too close, all of those things are taken into consideration before we mark out and flag the new mowing lines, and so that the new turf areas and the new fairways have every opportunity to grow healthy grass, much like the center of the fairway has done for years and years and years.
So we've talked about a handful of Golden Age architects already that you've worked on. I'm curious, and it's a question I ask almost every architect that comes on here. Who do you feel is the most underappreciated architect from the Golden Age?
I'm selfish in this statement, but it's someone that I just think does not get enough credit, and that's Perry Maxwell and his son Press. I think that Perry Maxwell was more than capable to be his own designer of record on many golf courses in the Midwest, which he does have his name attached to him, but it always seems to be portrayed the Midwest, or as the book was written about him, the Midwest Associate, Christopher Clouser wrote, Life and Work of Perry Maxwell, the Midwest Associate. But to me, he was more than that. He was helping Mackenzie create some of the coolest things in golf, Crystal Downs, Augusta National. He was at Pine Valley. I mean, he was in a lot of places helping a lot of architects look good. And I just wish that he would get his due or more people would talk about him, because I'm fascinated by his greens and I'm fascinated what he did with the nine holes at Prairie Dunes and eventually what Press Maxwell did with the additional nine holes. It's one of my top five golf courses. I think everybody should see it, the Prairie Dunes, and I think that everybody should get a chance to see the famous greens of Maxwell, Perry Maxwell, and his son Press, who had a chance to interview before he passed away in Colorado, Press Maxwell. I learned a lot about his father, Perry, and I just wish he got more credit.
I can't remember who I had on the podcast, but they also mentioned that Perry Maxwell, as the most underappreciated, because his career was most hindered by the Great Depression. You know, when he really reached his height was, when the least golf course construction was happening.
Right. And just think if he would have been a few years earlier, the roaring 20s, what he could have done. And not that he doesn't have something to show for his name. He does. He has golf courses out there that have his name on it. But people tend to want to flatten out his greens, and they want to alter his look of the golf courses. And I'm like, I'm trying my best to stand up for every Maxwell I can, as well as other architects. Dave Axlin, who works for Coore & Crenshaw, wonderful man. he has done a lot of work at Prairie Dunes, wonderful job, and I always consider him a friend, and I enjoy his work. He has done his best to protect the look of Prairie Dunes to make sure nobody messes with it, because people always want to kind of flatten out the greens, and that really was the character of Perry Maxwell. Mostly underappreciated, but anytime I'm struggling for a style of green that I'd like to build, I always go back to my Maxwell roots, and I create one or two inside roll greens. I did that at Sabonic, and it's something that I enjoy. I wish more people appreciated.
It's usually the external contours, the big, bold external contours get all of the kind of praise, and, you know, they catch the eye. But I always am impressed with, you know, the great architects. Like, one that sticks out is like how Seth Rayner used internal contours, and he had these big, bold external ones, but these subtle spines and humps and bumps in the green were the ones that, you know, really wreaked havoc.
I agree. I think Rayner you're talking about one of my other favorite guys, Seth Rayner, but I think Maxwell's little inside rolls were underappreciated. I think the bold inside rolls of Rayner, which were much more apparent, McDonald and Rayner, but Maxwell, just the little things sometimes make a big difference.
So I'm assuming, say you could transport back to 1928, we'll say, and you could have either Robert Hunter working with you, the McKenzie's other famed associate, or Perry Maxwell. Who would you choose? Maxwell?
Wow, great question. Nobody's ever asked me that. They always talk about the lead guys. And for me, I think the guys in the background are the forgotten ones. And luckily, Robert Hunter was able to publish a book, The Links by Robert Hunter, which gave him credit and fame. And Perry Maxwell, certainly with Old Town Golf Club that Coor and Crenshaw expertly restored, and Prairie Dunes and some of the other places that Perry Maxwell worked on, certainly had credit. But it's the guys that you never hear about. And one of the group of people that you never hear about, and again, I'm digressing, going away from your question, but Perry Maxwell had a gentleman by the name of, I can't remember his name, Woods, Ray Woods. Woods was a guy that helped Maxwell create some of the best golf courses ever. And I remember interviewing Press Maxwell at the Pinehurst Club in Denver, Colorado. That's where he was a member, Press Maxwell. I asked him how they built their greens and how they would go about the greens. And he talked about the Woods brothers and how they would go out there and they would stand in the fairway and they would, you know, eyeball how they wanted the green to look, and they would build it and talk about it. And I asked Press Maxwell, I said, did the Wood brothers ever survey their greens? And he said, no, they never did. All they did was just eyeballing, and if it looked like it wasn't too steep, and with the green speeds of that time, if they didn't look too steep, that they were good. And so Perry Maxwell had the Wood brothers. McKenzie had Robert Hunter. But who would I use? I'd probably use them both, because the more the merrier. And if your common goal with Robert Hunter and Perry Maxwell, as my associates, if the common goal was the good of the golf course and building 18 wonderful holes, not great holes, wonderful holes, then I'd use them both. And I'm sure that each one of them would lend their expertise at the right time, at the right place. Perry Maxwell maybe on the greens, Robert Hunter on the bunkers, which I believe Robert Hunter had most 98% of the credit for the beauty of McKenzie's bunkers, because every golf course that Robert Hunter worked on, those bunkers were pretty doggone good. And they're not just jigsaws, but the way they layered them, Robert Hunter had a lot to do with that. So I'd use them both. Is that fair, or is that a cop-out?
It's kind of a cop-out, but, you know, you at least gave what you'd use each of them for. So I think
Thank you.
nobody would agree or nobody would disagree with Hunter's bunkering and Maxwell's greens. I mean, you get the best of both worlds.
That's an all-star cast right there. Wouldn't even need Jim Urbina. You put those two guys together and be super duper.
Well, they got to have a CEO, which, you know, McKenzie was the CEO. So
McDonald was the CEO. They were both, based on everything I read, they were pretty egotistical. So I guess you need that, don't you?
Yeah, somebody's got to be the boss.
Somebody's got to be the boss.
So, you've worked on, you know, Paso Tiempo, the Valley Club.
Yes. Yes.
With McKenzie, you know, everybody loves his bunkering. You know, the deception's always talked about and the playability. What aspect of McKenzie do you think kind of gets swept under the rug but was really great about his designs?
The beauty, which, as you know, he's been quoted many times in many articles. Any architect worth his salt, and I'm paraphrasing, any architect worth his salt realizes that the beauty of the golf course is as important as the strategy. And what better place to stand and say that statement than the 16th tee at Cypress Point, or the first tee at Paso Tiempo overlooking the peninsula, or the Valley Club of Montecito, standing on the 15th green, walking over to the 16th tee and seeing the Pacific Ocean. Easy to say that. But really what I think that a lot of people think of a McKenzie, and I now know Robert Hunter bunker, is they think if they just build a jigsaw bunker, somehow that's a McKenzie bunker. And that is so far from the truth. One of the things I learned working at the Valley Club of Montecito is the way that Robert Hunter and McKenzie layered the bunkers. And what they did, and I'd love to take you back there someday with me to the Valley Club of Montecito, Andy, that'd be a lot of fun. I'd show you the layering. And I realized that when I was restoring the bunkers, I thought, man, these bunkers are like fitting right next to each other, even though they're 90 and 100 yards apart. And I started to, when I was reshaping them, and so I don't forget, I had very talented shapers helping me all along the way. But let's go there sometime later in the interview. When I started to realize that these features, these bunkers, they weren't just jigsaws, but they were fingers that were layered on top of each other so that at the right angle and at the right location in the fairway, one bunker would look like he was on top of the other. And the Valley Club kept doing that over and over and over on the 13th hole, on the 6th hole, on the 5th hole, on the 17th hole. And I started to realize this isn't just happenstance. They weren't just winging it out here. There was somebody standing there making sure that was the right elevation. And that's what I learned about a McKenzie Hunter bunker, that they weren't just jigsaws and they weren't just beautiful. They were intricate. They were integral. They were attached to each other. And in certain parts of the round of golf, when you stood in certain parts of the fairway, they were actually attached to each other. And the best one I could show you is on the 5th hole at the Valley Club of Montecito, because it's got about a 6% grade going uphill. And so the bunkers at eye level just seem to be layered perfectly. And a right center fairway bunker, if you're standing in the right location, looks like it matches up to the right greenside bunker. And if you're on the other side of the fairway, that center bunker looks like it matches up to the left greenside bunker. And I thought, this is beyond cool. This is so much different. And every time I would laugh when somebody would talk about a McKenzie bunker and just show a jigsaw, I said, if they only knew.
Yeah, that's. I feel like that's, you know, with almost everything, there's so many people try, you know, McKenzie's obviously got beautiful bunkers, and what happens is people try and mimic them, but, you know, there's something about the original, and there's so much that goes into something in somebody's head that's, you know, that nobody can really replicate that except for, you know, people that really understand it at a very deep level. And you
agreed.
Know, hey, this is full of McKenzie bunkers, but you're missing the point. And I think Bill Coore, when he was on our, on the podcast, was talking about how, you know, Pete Dye changed golf course architecture twice. And what happened was, you know, after Harbortown, you saw a lot of courses look like Harbortown, but then, you know, those courses that looked like it weren't Harbortown because they were missing that, you know, the strategy and the subtleness of the Dye designs.
Yes. Yes. And I totally agree with Bill Coore. One of my, someday, Andy, when I grow up, I want to be like Bill Coore.
I think a lot of people would.
But the Valley Club of Montecito, I'll never forget standing on the 15th fairway, and I was restoring the upper level bunker behind the 15th green at Paso Temple. I wish I had a photo you could put up and show, because the greens chairman at the time, Mr. Anderson, said, "Jim, why are you restoring that one? It's so out of play." And I said, "Well, because that bunker is not really for the 15th hole." And he laughed at me, and I said, "Come on, let's go over to the 18th tee box." And I took him over to the 18th tee box, and I showed him how the layering of bunkers going up the left side of 18 at the Valley Club layered in perfectly with the right greenside bunkers and the left greenside bunkers on 15, and made the upper bunker above 15 be a part of 18. And he says, "I would have never noticed that." And I said, "That's why it's here." And that's the beauty of Mackenzie. And you see it at Cypress Point, hole number 11. You see it at the Claremont Club in Berkeley, Oakland, California, that I'm working on right now. You see it at the Valley Club of Montecito. You see it at Paso Temple. It's that layering on top of beauty that make Mackenzie and Hunter bunkers so wonderful to restore. And, you know, that was a life lesson, and I'm so lucky to have been able to restore Paso Temple, because it taught me a lot about scale. It taught me a lot about deception. It taught me a lot about layering. It taught me a lot about strategy. And I thought, this is my open book education on golf, just by working and restoring places like the Valley Club and Paso Temple.
Yeah, it's I usually say to people that if they, you know, want to get into architecture, you got to go play like a really great course, and then you'll feel enlightened.
And not only play it, Andy, as you know, you have to walk it from side to side, and you have to experience it from all levels. That's why I crack up. I just can't believe somebody can rate a golf course, tell you all about it in one visit.
Yep.
These golf courses are way more complicated. The Golden Age golf courses are way more complicated than that. And for somebody to stand on the 16th green at San Francisco Golf Club, a golf course I had a chance to restore all the greens and some of the bunkering, to stand on that green and say, "Oh, this green is, you know, front to back or back to front and, you know, pretty good hole." They don't even understand the nuances of that green. And until you've worked on it, and until you've played it 100 times, until you've putted it in all different directions, do you understand the intricacies? And for some way, for someone to look at a golf course and one day in a 4 or 5 hour time period say, "That's an average golf course." I cringe when I think, that golf course deserves more attention than that. If that is a fair statement to say, it deserves way more attention than that.
I think walking a golf course, you learn way more about it than, I mean, almost Golf Digest raters or any raters should have to walk courses instead of play them, because walking them, they'll learn way more. You know, walk it with a wedge and a putter, you know?
Or a 7-iron, my favorite club.
Yeah.
Because that really tells you about what is available. And, you know, every game, everybody's game is different. You know, some people tend to play the right side of the fairway versus the left. Some people tend to stay on the ground, and some people hit it up the air. And I just wonder if, as you said, if they walk the golf course, and a lot of people don't have that time nowadays, but if they walk the golf course, got it like a kind of like a preview before they actually played it, how much better it would be. And I think people would appreciate designs more and not just think that it's just another 18 holes with 50 bunkers.
I think if they had to walk the course, or say they had to walk the course twice instead of playing it, which would probably take about the same time, they'd have a lot less raiders.
Well, they may have a lot less raiders and a lot less people visiting. You know, how many people want to go around and see 10 golf courses in a day? I know people who, I'm going to play 36 holes today or 54 holes today. And I think to myself, why not just give that golf course, that first one you have, give it 54 holes of your time. And it might be really, really good.
Yep. I agree. It's like, I've found myself, more and more thinking like, you need to really see a place a few times before you really pass judgment on it, because it's not fair to,
not fair.
Yeah. Especially if you're trying to compare it to somewhere where you've, played 6-7 times.
Yes. And you play Cypress Point 6 or 7 times because it's so beautiful, and you play the golf course inland just from there, from Cypress Point once, and try to compare the two, you can't do it.
No.
No, there's no way. Because you'll always lean to the beauty and the 6 or 7 times of memorable moments, and you give another golf course 4 hours of your time on the way. I don't know, man. It's hard for me to buy that.
It leads me into a question, with all your extensive California Mackenzie experience, and how would you split 10 rounds between all the Mackenzie California courses?
10 rounds, that's all I got.
Yeah. It's a tough one.
That's not fair.
Do you want 20?
No, I'll do 10. I would say that I would play Cypress Point twice.
All right. This is off to a good start.
Yep, that's a good start. Everybody would. I'll tell you what, a lot of people would laugh and say, I wouldn't play it twice. I'd play it 10 times and forget the rest of them.
Yeah.
But that's okay. You asked me, so I'm going to tell you. I would play the Valley Club twice. I would play Paso Tiempo twice. I would play the Claremont Club once. You got to see the Claremont Club. Have you ever seen it?
I made my first golf trip to San Francisco this fall. So I got to get back out to San Francisco. I only had 3 days, so I didn't get out there.
Go see the Claremont Club. It's a redo of a golf course by Alistair McKenzie and Robert Hunter. Some people, Sean Tully, a McKenzie historian who works at the Meadow Club, would say that maybe more Robert Hunter at the Claremont Club than McKenzie. But they do have a photo of McKenzie drinking a pint with Donald Ross on the 9th hole at Claremont. So he had to be there at least a little while.
That's pretty cool.
It is cool. It's a great photo. I have it up on my wall. It looks down on my computer. It's Ross and McKenzie with a pint with all the workers and people at the Claremont Club. It's great. But you got to see Claremont for the crossing fairways, probably the only club in America that still has crossing fairways. I would play the Meadow Club once. Wonderful golf course. Great walk in a beautiful setting. You got to go to the Cal Club, even though some people say, it was an Arthur A.V. McCann golf course, redone by McKenzie, redone by Kyle Phillips. But you gotta go to the Cal Club. Green Hills has wonderful history. I don't know if I would stop there. You got to go to Northwoods to play the 9-holer that McKenzie did up there in the Napa Valley. But I would split between Northwoods and Sharp Park.
Mm-hmm.
And you may ask, why Sharp Park? And many people would say, why Sharp Park? At that time, when that golf course was built, and it being a public golf course today, it was probably one of the coolest settings in California for golf. You could almost walk on the beach playing the two holes going to the south before they were washed away. And I've played golf there with Bo Lynx. I've played golf there with the group trying to restore it. I played golf there with Ron Witten when we walked and shared a golf bag. And we've all stood there and thought what this place could be like, what it was like before the dike was installed. And I think everybody who's a McKenzie or at least a Golden Age architect history buff should go see Shark Park and stand there and think what it was at one time in the history of golf architecture, how cool it would be. Did that total 10?
I think you got 10. Yeah. I mean,
I lucked out.
I think Northwoods, since it's only 9, I've seen pictures. That place looks so cool.
Yeah, you got to go.
Yeah.
See,
there's
gotta
just too many places. I got to go do just a pure McKenzie tour.
Yep.
Of the West Coast. It's,
yep.
With that.
So that's my 10.
Yeah.
I'm sure everybody would tell you something different, Andy. You would probably come up with different numbers, but that's my 10.
That's the beauty of golf courses. Everybody has a little bit different taste, and everybody has a little bit, different view on what's good and what's great. And but all of them are awesome. I was at Pasatiempo. God, I've told some people this, but that place is got to be one of, if not the most architecturally sound course that anybody can go play.
Unbelievable place. And I've been lucky to be associated with Pasatiempo for 20 years. I'm actually going back there in January. We're going to continue to do some tee box work. And somebody would say, well, why is the tee boxes so important? The starting ground so important? And if you've ever read in Robert Hunter's book, The Links, he talks about in a chapter how a golf course should start. And he said that the golf course should start and finish in the same manner, as close to the ground as possible and with the same intent. And that's, again, a paraphrase. But working with the superintendent and the Greens Committee at Pasatiempo, we're going to try to get some of that flavor back in the teeing grounds. Again, working there for 20 years, working with the greens, expansion of the greens. It's been a treat. You are right. It's an architectural genius golf course using the Barrancas. Could I have put Pasatiempo in front of Cypress Point? Probably. I probably could have played 3 or 4 times at Pasatiempo and twice at Cypress in the Valley Club. But you can't pass up the beauty of Cypress Point, but Pasatiempo has everything that any golfer would want in architectural design and strategy. And what a place, as you have attested to.
Yeah, I think you look at it, they get so many rounds a year, but that's another reason why it's almost unfair to compare golf courses like that. Like, because if that golf course, if it was a really exclusive club that got 10,000 rounds a year, you could do, a little bit more, stuff that would probably make it one of the 5 to 10 best golf courses in America.
Well, there's a point in which you have to decide. And your point about being private versus public, I think the bonus about it being public is more people get to experience it.
Yep.
And for me, the more people that get to see Pasatiempo and McKenzie and Hunter's genius, the better. Maybe there's just not enough exposure to other McKenzie courses, but because Pasatiempo is public, more people get to play it. So I think it's a good thing. But yes, could you do something different? Yeah, you probably could. Not much different. You couldn't change much, but man, the ability for the public to play Potsdam Temple, what a place. And that we were able to keep the golf course open during that whole time of restoring it, which was the key point. That was the key point to this. And you brought this question up at the beginning of our discussion. You said, how do you get the club to buy into something? Well, the intent of Potsdam Temple, the statement says, nothing will be done to this golf course that doesn't represent what Potsdam Temple and McKenzie's strategies, designs, intent was. And I used the old aerial, I used the ground photos, and that was my intent from the beginning. That was the club's intent from the beginning. And when we go back and do the teeing grounds next year, we will add one more step to the restoration of Potsdam Temple, and people will just love the look. They already like the look. What am I kidding myself? But we're just adding one more step to that to complete McKenzie's dream, where he passed away, where his house was located on the sixth hole, as you well aware. And it really is a Hall of Fame of holes for McKenzie.
So we've talked about a lot of great golf courses, and we've actually touched on the idea of scale and design. Do you think it's a necessity for, you know, really great golf design?
Scale?
Yep.
I would have said scale was important. The big scale was important because my favorite golf course, the National Golf Links of America, is big in scale. But there's something about having a border or a barranca or a tree line that invokes just a little more touch of strategy that I don't think you can downplay. So is scale important? Yes. If you were building big scale golf courses, I think they're phenomenal looking and fun to play and look at. Do I discount golf courses that are maybe a little bit smaller in scale, maybe a little narrower in playing corridor width? Yeah, maybe so. But I think that Potsdam Temple, on a little smaller scale, offers everything that the big scale National Golf Links of America offers. I think you could have both. I think mixing and matching is important. Opening up fairways in between holes. I have a great old photo again on my office wall of the first hole of Potsdam Temple when there were no trees in between 1 and 9, and it was one big open playing field. That's pretty big scale, and that's what McKenzie was working on when he was working at Potsdam Temple. You know, trees evolve, they grow up, it narrows the corridors, but I think you could have both. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. I think it's you know, it seems like with the modern new design, everything's going to massive scale, expansive fairways. But at the same time, you know, it's kind of the pendulum swinging in each direction, it seems like, with golf design. And I'm just, you know, I think it could get too big.
You know, we built Old MacDonald for Mike Kaiser at the Bandon Dunes Resort. I was involved with Pacific Dunes as well. Pacific Dunes, a little bit smaller scale. Old MacDonald, much bigger scale. And I could only use those two points of references in my discussion with you. For everything that Pacific Dunes offers the golfer in beauty and scale and playability, Old MacDonald offers something different. To play the first hole at Old MacDonald, upper right fairway, lower left fairway, center fairway with the principal's nose on the double plateau, that's, for me, fun. Links golf at its finest. But when you play, have you played Pacific Dunes in Old Mac, Andy?
You know, it's another place I got to get to. I worked too many years in tech and not enough years in golf.
Well, you'll get there, and I know you'll love all of the golf course. You'll love Trails for what it speaks of beauty. You'll love Bandon Dunes for what David Kidd did in the beginning that allowed us to all work there. And you'll like Pacific Dunes and Old Matt for different reasons. And I love the big scale of Old MacDonald. I love almost 5.5 acres of greens similar to St. Andrews in Scotland. I love that scale. I think it offers strategy. I think it offers a different playing field depending on the way the wind blows. I think it offers every golfer a chance to make a recovery shot. But for everything Old MacDonald offers in big scale, I think Pacific Dunes offers in a little bit more intimate scale, playing the seventh and eighth holes at Pacific Dunes. Those are fun holes to play, a little more intimate, a little more guarded around the greens, a little more interest. They're all different. Is big scale in vogue right now? Yeah, probably is. I saw Coore and Crenshaw's layout at the Sand Valley, and I saw David Kidd's layout at the Mammoth Dunes. Wow. Have you seen those yet?
Yeah, massive.
Wow.
I mean, Mammoth Dunes is aptly named. Because
aptly named. And should every golf course be Mammoth Dunes? You know, I don't know. But should everybody get a chance to play Coore and Crenshaw's Sand Valley and David Kidd's Mammoth Dunes? Absolutely. Because it offers something that maybe a lot of golfers don't ever get to experience, and that is the array of shots you can play without restriction. And that's one of the things I learned at St. Andrews when I first went there, is a golf course without borders. And that has been my staple of design and the way I lay out grassing lines at new golf courses that I'm involved with, and the way I lay out presentation grassing lines on restorations. Try not to have a golf course with borders. It's so much more freedom. Mm-hmm. And I hope that people understand what I'm trying to say. Mammoth Dunes and Coore and Crenshaw Sand Valley, they give you the freedom to play, and that's so important.
Yeah, I think that's I'm a big proponent of width. You know, it's I think it's the but what you touched on, I think, is important, is that the great thing about golf is variety, and having variety among design theories is really important.
I think it is, and I think that for one of the things that I think Mike Kaiser did so wonderful at Bandon Dunes was that he gave you four different golf courses in the same setting. And that is variety. And I think Sand Valley is a little different than Mammoth Dunes up in Wisconsin. And a lot of the Golden Age designs, for example, my five favorite designs have so much different variety. I go from the National Golf Links of America to Prairie Dunes. What a contrast. I go from Pinehurst number 2, one of my top fives, to Cypress Point. What a contrast. And so I think about those golf courses being contrasting and having variety, and that's what the two golf courses I was involved with, the Bandon Dunes, give you, Pacific Dunes and Old Mac. They give you variety. That's all you want. You want something different and not the same old.
That does it for part one of our podcast with Jim Urbina. Check in on the feed on Thursday for part two.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.